All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We are going to be recording 1 or 2 hours of general questions today, depending on how many questions we get. I will tell you, if you jump in right now with a question, a comment, a topic, press 1 on your phone. I guarantee you I'll get to you. The longer you wait, the harder it is to get through. And most shows I end up not getting to all the questions. I'll keep you updated on if we have any room for questions or not as we go. We're going to get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, bring it to the show. We'll talk about it here. We've had some good conversations over the last couple weekends about what's going on with rates and lanes and freight volume and brokers. And I've run into an attitude that I've run into many, many times over the last couple of decades. And that is someone who believes that they can't learn from somebody else unless that somebody else is doing exactly what they're doing. And that is just a lousy attitude to have. For example, you know, when I give a lot of information about fuel economy and somebody will say, well, you just don't get it because you've never pulled this kind of trailer or you've never been in this kind of operation. Well, the minute you do that, then you're just shutting down the ability to learn anything. Fuel mileage is physics. You know, physics haven't changed in a very long time. That's kind of sarcastic. The laws of physics aren't changing. We can apply the laws of physics to fuel mileage. I don't care what kind of truck or trailer or freight. It's physics. I don't have to go pull a livestock trailer to know how to improve fuel economy pulling a livestock trailer. And that applies to most things. I don't have to be doing exactly what you're doing to know how to do it better, to learn a way to do it better. It's much better to be open to the information, take what you hear, try it, and see what works. But to shut down and just say, well, you can't teach me anything because you're not doing exactly what I'm doing. So I got thinking about that. And it's actually a little sad, but I thought about everything I've learned about business and trucking, and most of it, the vast majority of it, I did not learn from anybody in trucking. I haven't had any real mentors in trucking. Now, I've certainly learned a lot about engines from Bruce Mallinson and about tires and alignment from Mike Beckett, and I've learned from people, but they're not out driving trucks or owning trucks or operating trucks. I learned about something very specific from them. Most of what I've learned about business came from people who have nothing whatsoever to do with trucking at all. The other thing I see people falling into is this trap that in order for something to be valid, it has to be new and cutting edge. There's nothing wrong with learning new stuff. But you know what? We don't need to reinvent the wheel. I got thinking about some of the books and authors that have had the biggest impact on me, the stuff that I really learned from. And it's interesting. I was thinking about the first book that I read that was about, whether you want to call it self-help or learning something. I've always been a big reader, but I used to read just novels. And I remember where I was. I had to be probably 19 or 20 because I was still in the Army. And I would go to bookstores, didn't have a Kindle back then. So I would spend time in bookstores, and I bought a lot of books. But again, they were all novels. And I was at in a checkout line, and I was waiting, and I looked down, and I see this book, and the title was The Power of Positive Thinking, Norman Vincent Peale. And it caught my attention, and I thought, well, that's different. I'll read that. And I was hooked. I've been reading books like that ever since. I've read over 1,000 books on business, leadership, goal setting, self-help, personal development, but nothing specifically about trucking. And nothing, and I read a lot of new stuff, but the books that have the biggest impact are really old. The Power of Positive Thinking was written 64 years ago. Still a really powerful message, though. So some of the other books that have had a really big impact on me: The War of Art, written 15 years ago. 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, 27 years ago. How to Win Friends and Influence People, 80 years ago that book was written. That if you want to learn how to build relationships or sell or negotiate, that is a great foundation. That book by Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and it was written 80 years ago, still valid today. Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, 79 years old. The book is 79 years old. Those are classics that those lessons apply today. I could go on and on. Like I say, there's nothing wrong with reading new stuff. I read books, new books that come out every week or every month. But I seldom find a book that has the kind of impact some of the classics had. That's why they become classics. This information is timeless. People don't really change, and these books are about people. So don't get stuck in that mindset that in order for you to learn something from somebody, they have to be doing exactly what you're doing or they don't get it. In fact, if you're in trucking and you're waiting for somebody to come along to teach you something that does exactly what you do, you're going to be waiting a long time. I mean, I can't find any books about trucking. That's why I wrote one. I can't find any seminars really about trucking. That's why I give them. I wish there were more, but you don't. It doesn't have to be about trucking. You take books with really good business lessons or books about goal setting or personal development or whatever it is, and you read them and you get the lessons and then you apply them in your own life and your own operation, and then you tweak them. And that's what I've been doing for a couple decades. So don't shut yourself off to all that good information that's out there. On the other hand, many times you should be very careful about taking advice from somebody who may be doing exactly what you're doing. It may or may not be good advice. Just because they do what you do doesn't mean they have really good lessons. They might. So be open to information in more places. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's go to Arizona. Raphael, welcome to the program.
Hey, had a question about going to Mount Authority or how soon you think I'm ready to go to Mount Authority.
Okay. So go ahead.
I've been leasing like the past 3 years, and I don't know if you remember me, but I was leased on to a carrier last year. I was on their lease program, and my take home was about $70,000. after everything paid out, I average about 62 cents take-home pay. And I try to get the truck financed, but they backed out of it where they wanted to finance them themselves. So I went out and bought me a $10,000 truck.
Okay,
I've had it on the road since starting the year. And I'm averaging about 75 cents take-home pay.
Wow. So what is the gross revenue per mile? I imagine
gross
it's got to be around $1.50, $1.60.
Yeah, I'm still about $1.60 a mile, and I'm leased onto a carrier still. I leased onto a smaller carrier that would take a 2,000 freight liner.
Okay, got it. So it sounds to me like you have accounting and you know your numbers, right?
Yes.
Okay. And that's step one, really. So many times I see people who want to go get their own authority, and they're not even doing any accounting where they are now. That's just a bad place to be in. So I'm glad you've got that part done. Let me get to a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about what's next right after this. Stick around. We'll be back with more stuff from Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm going to get right back to the phone calls. I was talking with Raphael in Arizona. So give me probably one or two reasons why you want to get your own authority.
Take home more money. That's how I kind of see it. More money, have home time planned better.
Okay. So kind of money and control over your schedule.
Yes.
The money part right now might actually be a little tough. Are you pulling general freight?
Yeah, general freight. I'm a flatbed. I go from California, Southern Cal, to Texas and back.
Got it. So, well, I'll take that back then. Making that kind of money with a flatbed right now isn't that difficult. General freight, a lot of guys aren't making $1.60 a mile right now with their own authority because rates are down. Flatbed's still fairly strong. It's not doing that bad. So, yeah, I think, you know, if you're financially ready, you know, moving to your own authority can be a little rough for the first 60 to 90 days, depending on how much work you put in ahead of time. Like, if you were to keep doing what you're doing right now, would you also have time here and there to go out and start building some relationships with brokers before you pull the trigger on this?
Yes. Actually, with the guy I'm with, we contacted one of my old brokers with the companies I used to work with, and we haul some of their materials. So, yeah, I've been working on customers and some brokers already for the past 3 years.
Excellent. So, if you're in a pretty good financial position, are you? I mean, if you had a month where, let's say, you know, your revenue got cut in half, for a month or two, would you still be okay?
Oh, yeah. Yep. I keep my home expenses out of control. I take control on that pretty good. If it goes over a certain limit, I start freaking out, even though I make good money.
Well, it sounds to me like you've got a lot of stuff taken care of. You know your numbers. Your numbers are good. You're managing your cash well, so you're not in a problem there. You've already started working on relationships with brokers and customers. You've really got it under control. I think you're ready to pull the trigger on this, and if not ready right now, you're very close.
All right. Yeah, that's what I wanted to know. I had my goal was around August, I was thinking about just going for it, and that was my plan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you're ready. I mean, you are far more prepared than most people that I see do this. You've done all the right stuff.
All right. Well, that's all I needed to hear.
All right. Congratulations. I love it when people have a plan and they work the plan and they're patient. That's how people succeed. It works. Let's go to, going to head to the Mexican border. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Fair tax yesterday there, Kevin.
Absolutely. What's on your mind today?
Listen, I got two questions. One's very quick, one's not. I was talking to some owner-operators, at least I went Landstar, about buying fuel on the company card, and I'm paying cash out of pocket. Somebody said I could really shoot myself in the foot doing that, but they couldn't give me any reasons. Kind of wondering, am I shooting myself in the foot doing that?
Paying cash?
Paying cash out of pocket instead of using the company card.
All I really care about when I buy fuel is how do I get the best price? And there's a cash price, so we can save some money that way. If there's a discount card available and I could save more money by running the purchase through a discount card, then I would do that. But there's nothing wrong with paying cash. All we're trying to accomplish is get the best price. So if we're at a particular stop and the best price is just cash because we don't have any kind of a discount program, then absolutely pay cash. The only other thing that it affects is in some programs, if you use the card for every purchase, then you're done as far as fuel tax goes. If you use some other means, then you have to turn in those receipts. That's no big deal. Other than that, I don't know what they could mean by you're shooting yourself in the foot using cash. I don't know what they could be talking about.
Well, I didn't either, but he had a lot of experience, and it got me scared, so I figured I'd ask. I've got my fuel costs down. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I think you did the right thing, because this is what I tell people. When somebody gives you some advice or tells you something like that, then the next question should always be why. Sounds like you asked him why, and he couldn't explain it.
I've got my fuel cost down to about 21 cents a mile. It's right there on that borderline between 21 and 22. And I'm buying gas in Oklahoma, fuel in Oklahoma, where it's just super cheap and, at gas stations. So I've got that under control. It really scared me when he said that. Now, question number two, and I'm looking for a reason not to, but so far I'm only finding reasons to. Not buy a second truck to put on, but to kind of have it on the side as a rainy day truck in case truck number one ever, does something crazy.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's one of those things that if you can afford it, for me, and especially in the operation that I ran for years where, we had dedicated runs. You had to cover your run. And if you didn't have a truck to cover your run, not only was it, could it be points against you on the contract, which were important, but it also meant that I had a driver not working that day. and that doesn't make drivers happy. So there were many, many times during the years that I had that contract that I did just have a truck sitting that didn't do anything other than function as a backup truck when I needed one. And sometimes I'd go months and months and months and never use it. But for me, I loved the security of having that truck there. And once in a while, you know, I could pick up some extra work with it or you know, something. So it's one of those things that if your operation is at a place where you can afford to have a truck there and it's not a big financial burden, it's a way to provide better value to your customer because it may, you know, allow you not to miss a load someday.
That being said, like I say, I know I'm not in a spot to put a driver in it or anything because I'm still learning Landstar's way and everything. I mean, would it be one of those things that potentially I could put another driver in it? I know that sounds like a weird question, but I just don't think I'm ready yet.
No, I think that's the best way to ask this question is, of course, we can always buy a truck and put a driver in it, but you're asking the right question. When do you know that you're ready?
Yes, sir.
It's a great question to ask. It's a hard question to answer. But the good news is that if you're asking the question, you're at least thinking about it. And so many people jump into this without really thinking it through. You know, my criteria for when you're ready, a big one is, first of all, have you really maximized profit in your own operation, in your first truck? Because if not, if there's still, and maybe you have, if there's still more you could do, maybe, you know, increasing revenue by learning better rates and lanes or building a better relationship with a small group of agents or whatever it might be. Or can you still lower costs by working on fuel economy and, you know, maintenance costs? And do you have your tax costs as low as possible? Otherwise, I think your time is more profitably spent maximizing the profit on your first truck. It's easier. You have more control over it. If you're to that point where you go, look, you know, I might be able to squeeze a penny or two out here, or I might be able to add 5 cents to revenue, but I'm going to have to work really hard to do it, then that's probably the time when you're financially ready. Then you have to look at the kind of the personality side of things. Are you the kind of person that can have employees? Some people, it makes them absolutely insane. You know, and if that's the case, who wants to go through that hell every day? Drivers can be frustrating, but it can also be very rewarding to have more trucks and start to grow that. So hold that thought. Let me get to a break, and we'll come back. We'll cover a couple more things on that, and then we'll get to more of your calls and questions. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the calls. I was talking with Stuart. So, Stuart, that's kind of the way I break it up into those two different areas. One, financial. You know, have I really kind of maximized what I can do with my first truck? And two, am I really ready to be an employer and deal with a second truck that is going to break down at some point, a driver, There's no right or wrong answers to those. That's just something you've got to kind of work through and understand your personality. But, you know, once you work through those two, then especially if we're not going out making a huge investment in the truck, sometimes, you know, you pull the trigger and see what happens. You know, I kind of have a theory of ready, fire, aim, which sounds a little goofy, but ready means I'm going to do everything I can to get ready, you know, kind of work through the two things I just talked about. Then I'm going to pull the trigger, you know, let's do this and see what happens. And then I'm going to kind of say, well, I missed the mark a little bit there. Let's tweak it. Let's aim. So kind of ready, fire, aim is the way I do, you know, make most of these decisions.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, that, I'm just so scared I'm going to do the wrong thing, you know, and really, really screw things up here. And I'm really unsure about myself in a lot of things. That's why I always have to call and ask for advice. But one other thing before I leave you, the last two shows you did over the weekend were just excellent. I love the way the last couple of shows went. I think they were some of the best shows you've had in a long time.
Well, thank you. I did too. I mean, I love doing what I do. I love answering very specific questions about this or that, but I also love getting into those kind of deeper discussions and what, you know, whether they're discussions, debates, downright arguments. I think that can help us think in different ways. So I love those two shows as well.
All right. Well, I'll get back over to I'll get back over there and I'll send you my profit gauges next week, and
okay.
I guess we could go over it then.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, that
sir.
Sounds good. And you're welcome. Let's go to Tennessee. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I will be so brief with you. Happy birthday.
Is it my birthday today?
Yep, and you're 53 today.
I am. That sounds crazy. 53. I don't feel 53.
You don't look 53 either, okay?
Well, thank you.
You really don't. You're looking good. So I just wanted to be wishing you a happy birthday because you do mean an awful lot in mine and my husband's life as far as the trucking life. I mean, you guys are remarkable. So,
well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. So keep up the good work, and thanks for the birthday wishes. It is my birthday today. You know, it's just a day. You know, I appreciate that. I've never been real big on holidays of any kind. I do find it hard to believe that I'm 53, though. Let's go to Philadelphia. Leo, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good. What can I help you with today?
Good. All right. Me and my better half, we're working on our diet. Things is going great. We're getting the grass-fed meat. The whole nine yards.
Good.
Good. But this is what I'm having a challenge. I love my coffee in the morning. In the morning there, I love the Dunkin' Donuts, Starbucks, the whole nine yards. I want to get into this bulletproof coffee.
Okay.
So the day I'm at the house, at your house there in the kitchen, you say, hey, Leo, I'm going to make you some coffee. How do you make this again? Because we made some this morning, and I just don't think we did it right. So,
here's
out
the
there.
Thing. Yeah,
okay.
People who love coffee, this has been 100% so far, and I have introduced a lot of people to Bulletproof Coffee. People who love coffee love Bulletproof Coffee, like over the top. So there are a couple different ways you can make it. Let's talk about the most basic. So, depending on how you like your coffee, I like a really dark roast, strong coffee. I mean, I don't
Bingo.
Even a medium roast. Yeah. I mean, if I have to get a medium roast, it's like just not very satisfying for me. So make sure you start with a coffee you like. Then the basic recipe, I would start with 1 tablespoon of grass-fed butter, like Kerrygold is the easiest one to find.
Yep,
I think
got that at Walmart.
Salted, yeah, I think salted works better, but mm-hmm. you can use unsalted, doesn't really matter. And then 1 tablespoon of virgin coconut oil. So,
okay.
And but here's the trick. You have to blend it. You can't just stir it in. So, like a Nutribullet, any kind of a blender. The Nutribullet actually is a little tricky. If you just blast it with the Nutribullet, it'll get a little frothy on top. So I like ease into it if I use a Nutribullet. If you're using a blender with a variable speed, it's easy to just blend it on a lower setting. And it should taste like a really creamy, non-sweet latte. So it's going to have that rich, creamy. I don't notice any coconut flavor whatsoever in mine. Some people say that they do notice it. I just don't. That's the basic recipe. And everybody I've ever given that to just falls in love with it. Now, I jazz mine up a little bit. So I tend to use 2 tablespoons of butter, and I use a tablespoon of what's called brain octane, which is a liquid form of a coconut oil that's, I don't want to say more concentrated, it's more targeted. They pull out one specific MCT oil out of coconut oil because it's the one MCT oil that helps your body produce ketones better. It comes from a company called Bulletproof, and that's where the whole Bulletproof coffee idea came from. The same guy that developed the original recipe ended up working out this brain octane oil that's even better. But regular coconut oil, virgin coconut oil, works excellent. I like to put a little bit of raw chocolate powder in mine, like a teaspoon of raw chocolate powder. And I put in about 4 really good shakes of cinnamon. And cinnamon, the flavor I love, and cinnamon is a really healthy spice. It's got antioxidants, it's anti-inflammatory, it does all kinds of good stuff. So that's my recipe. 2 tablespoons of butter, 1 tablespoon of brain octane or coconut oil, 1 teaspoon of raw chocolate powder, and about 3 or 4 really good shakes of cinnamon. And then blend it. And it's amazing.
Good deal. Okay. I know where I went wrong there. I didn't blend it as well. I got the old spoon out and that didn't work.
You end up with an oil slick on the top, and it doesn't get that rich, creamy kind of feel to it. So blending is a must.
Okay. And one last question there. My better half, she loves almonds. I mean, she eats it all day. And she's just concerned, is that a bad thing? I told her no, but can you have too much almonds? Yeah, that's what I mean.
Well,
almonds,
you know,
and pistachios.
We could potentially have too much of anything. But I kind of doubt that she's eating too many of them. The one thing you do want to try when you're going to eat a food on a regular basis, almonds are excellent. They're good fat. They've got, a lot of nutrients. That's good food. Here's what I love about that kind of food. There's no real ingredient list. It might be almonds and salt. Now, the one thing you want to watch, nuts that have been, that have had an industrial seed oil added. So if you look on the list and there's soybean oil or cottonseed oil or vegetable oil of any kind, then you want to stay away from those. You want to stay away from any of the flavored nuts because they just douse them with a bunch of chemicals for the flavor. I prefer, when I can find them, raw organic nuts. I can't always find them, so I'll just try to get as close as I can. But other than that, I eat a ton of nuts. My favorite are macadamia nuts, and those are crazy healthy.
Okay, good deal. All right, well, thanks a lot, Kevin. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Now, there is some concern of nuts and what are called anti-nutrients. Nuts have phytates in them and phytic acid that can block absorption of other minerals and vitamins. The proper way is to actually get them raw and soak them and then re-dehydrate them. It's a lot of work. I do it sometimes, but not all that often. And I eat a lot of nuts. I don't see the whole anti-nutrient thing being a big deal, especially if you're getting a lot of nutrition in your diet from eating whole, real food. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothstein. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment of the first hour, and we're going to do another hour. So at the end of this one, I'm going to say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff I always say at the end of a show. Don't hang up because we're going to come back and do another one. There may be some room. If you are still wondering if you could get in with a question or a comment, if you press one right now, you might have a chance, and I'll keep you updated as we go through the next hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get back to the phones. I'm off to Chicago this time. Howard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for taking my call.
What can I help you with today?
I believe you have an oil sample in front of you there.
All right, let's take a look. What do we got going on here? Looks like we might be possibly climbing on some fuel dilution. And it looks like it might also be affecting viscosity a little bit. Not seeing any real problem with wear metals, though. Whoa, what the hell? Oh, copper. But when we see copper alone, especially when it does a number like that, goes from 3 to 517, the only thing that ever causes that, we have no idea why this happens. For some reason, the oil cooler will start leaching copper. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the oil cooler. In fact, most of the time, there isn't anything. Sometimes it happens to a new cooler. Sometimes it happens to a cooler that's a million miles old. And I've never been able to find an explanation for why it does it. But the good news is it doesn't hurt a thing. It doesn't hurt to have that copper in the oil, and there's nothing wrong with the truck most of the time. So fuel dilution isn't high enough that I would do anything about it right now. Just keep an eye on it, and I would just kind of ignore the copper.
Is that right? Because I've got 100,000, maybe 105,000 on the in-frame on this engine, and this is the first extended drain over 25,000 miles. And that's why I was just – and the oil that they have me, I sent them – I changed it on my homepage about the Shell Rotella. They have the regular 10W40. I went to a full synthetic, the 5W40 of the Modelo. They haven't –
so
that might
– okay. So then that makes me feel a little better, because that's why the viscosity is where it is then. That's exactly what it should be. So the fuel dilution is probably having no effect on this at all. The extended drain had nothing to do with this copper. This would have happened. It could have happened in the first 5,000 miles. That when it happens fast. Like I said, nobody's ever really been able to explain to me what happens, but we know it doesn't
right.
hurt anything. So I wouldn't worry about it. This sample looks good.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Kevin. I appreciate your help.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, it's an odd thing. I mean, as long as copper is an issue, if we see lead first and then copper starts to climb slowly, that means we've gone through the lead coating on the bearings, main and rod bearings, and now we're starting to wear out the copper, and that's a bad sign. But you have zero lead, and copper shot up like crazy. It's always an oil cooler when that happens. Let's go to Missouri. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I put white singles on my truck a while back, and I run a single axle truck, really light operation. Well, I cut one down about a week and a half ago. Now I have 18/32 on the one side, and the new one on the other side, 24/32. I wondered if that's a problem or not.
No. No, it's not. Differential itself is going to make up that difference. That's not a real big difference, and it's not going to hurt anything when they're on opposite sides of the truck. Now, if you try to put two tires next to each other, two duals, and you've got that much of a difference, it's going to cause a problem. But the differential can more than make up for this. It's not a big deal at all.
All right, I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, it's kind of what the differential does, and that's where it gets its name. It makes up the difference between the revolutions of the two-wheel ends. So whether you're going around a corner when the outside tire has to spin a lot more times than the inside tire, that's what the differential is making up for. So going down the road, your smaller tire has got to spin more times than the bigger tire, but the differential's handling that. Same way if we have smaller tires on one axle or the other, on a tandem axle, the power divider can make up that difference as well. Let's go to Louisiana. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hello, sir.
Can I help you with today?
Well, I was calling to give you an update. I spoke to you back just prior to Thanksgiving. We had saved up and bought a brand new 2016 780, and we're out running with Mercer after driving 5 years with the company. Just after speaking with you, we kept going over about how the system was leaking air every 10 minutes, and everybody was telling me it was because of the 13 speed and the fan and all this other types of stuff, and we were laughing about it.
Right.
Well, just after that, I picked up in Primeville and Mandris, I believe, is up near there. I blew the motor on the D13 with 19,000 miles on it.
Oh, when we say we blew it, what happened? Did we did a rod break, a wrist pin, a ring? What was it?
They are not completely sure. Bearing number 3 was shredded, and 2 other bearings were bad.
Okay, so we lost bearings then.
I was down. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's bad.
It shredded out.
So I'm assuming there's so much damage that we can't just replace bearings.
Right. So I was down until just before Christmas there. They put a new engine in. Great group out in Colberg, Eugene, Volvo out there.
Uh-huh.
We got an engine in. Problem before I reached Space Coast truck stop, leaving out of Oregon there. And then it was downhill from there. At that point, it was a regen problem, a def problem. Once that cleared, we began to have losing Jake brakes, 3 different issues. Oh. We blew out the, was it the dryer system or the airline system at the rear of the cab at a shipper, so we couldn't pull the trailer off. The other one went bad on the fuel, on the rail system. And then it got worse from there. We ended up being 19 days down in Joplin. They replaced the turbo on the new engine, the top rail system, the SRC, the DEF system, the dozer sprayer went out. It was just completely downhill.
So how many days total have you been off the road with all these problems?
We bought that truck at the end of September, went over to Mercer, beginning of October, and we were down approximately 40 business days out of 3.5 months. We started working with a gentleman from Volvo named Damien. He was fantastic with us, and what eventually happened was they gave us back all our deposit on the truck.
Wow. Well, that's, I hope it works out. With the lesson I want people listening to understand, because so many times I hear people say, why would you listen to Kevin about buying some old million-mile truck when you buy a new truck, you get a warranty? Well,
absolutely.
I'm pretty sure you could give a rat's ass about your warranty right now.
Well, it was kind of toss in the hand. You know, when I told you before, we went between new and used, and we decided to go new because it was our first truck, and that's all we were going to buy ever new. And
right.
You know, this time the warranty saved us on all the repairs, except for hotel and downtime, as you know, and lost loads.
And that's what I want people to think about right now. So 40 days out of how many months?
3.5 months.
So 40 days out of 3.5 months. I want people to stop and look at their operation and see, could they afford a big truck payment on a new truck, 40
right.
days out of 3.5 months with no revenue and the cost of being out on the road, hotels, all those other things, and the aggravation. And if you
Absolutely.
Can put up with all that stuff, then knock yourself out, go buy a new truck.
it was aggravating.
I can't even imagine.
It's a toss-up. It's a toss-up. And once it was turned in, we went back to Mercer, and we went down to Kenworth, and we stuck to our guns. We're like, well, we want one new truck, and that's what we're going to do. And there's a place called Peterson. They give us a great deal, and we ended up leaving with one of those new Icons. And currently we get 6.8 loaded miles and on average about 7.5, 7.8 unloaded. That was the month after.
Well, thanks for catching me up on this. You have more guts than I have. And I really, really hope this one works out for you. I can tell you, in owning 30 or 40 trucks over the years, all pre-emission except one, I've never had a problem like that, ever. Nothing that even came close to that. And it just, it makes me crazy when this happens to good owner-operators. But that's the risk of these new trucks. And it's not an unusual story. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, so we're going to do another hour. Let me, I'll tell you right now, if you were to jump in and press 1 on your phone, there's a really good chance I will be able to get to you in this next hour. We blew through a couple of those calls pretty quick. So we're going to go ahead and get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Actually, welcome to the show. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your authority, you name it. We'll tackle it here on this show. At the open right there, I was a little distracted. I was thinking about a call I had on the last show where somebody bought a new truck, and in 3.5 months, it was down 40 days. Required a new engine, some really horrendous stuff. And I hate hearing those kind of stories, but I hear them all the time. It's not uncommon. It's why I spend so much time talking about pre-emission trucks. And I was trying to think, I wish I would have kept track over the years how many trucks I've owned in the 30 years that I own trucks, and it's probably somewhere between 30 and 40. It's not that I bought new trucks every year, but I owned multiple trucks. At one point, I had 11. So I'm thinking that I had to buy somewhere between 30 and 40 trucks over that 30 years. And I can tell you, I had many, many trucks. My best trucks were from starting in about 1990 when I bought my first electronic Series 60 up until about 2005 when I bought my first emission truck. That run, 13 years or so, was the most dependable trucks I've ever owned. And I was thinking during that time, I would venture to say my business model was pretty much the same. I did buy new trucks back then. They were pre-emission. I spec'd them exactly the way I wanted them, and I kept them to about 1.2 or 1.3 million miles when they needed an in-frame, and I would go buy a new one. And I'm sure that all of the trucks I owned during that time, I don't think one of them ever had 40 days of downtime in the entire 1.3 million miles. I mean, I don't remember anything on those trucks that kept me off the road. They just worked. You know, if you did good routine preventative maintenance, trucks during that time just ran. I mean, things hardly ever broke, and when they did, it was usually just a couple hours in the shop and back on the road the next day. I'm sure I didn't have any truck during that time that had 40 days of downtime in its entire life, much less in the first 3.5 months. Definitely something to think about. Let's get to some phone calls today. Let's go to Missouri. Christine, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ken. Well, I didn't buy a new truck, but I bought one you said not to buy, but you have to give me a break because I've only been listening to you for about a month. So,
okay.
I
won't yell too much then.
Okay. I am a company driver right now, and it's sitting in my driveway because we got a line on some freight. We're going to run this freight, so I wanted to buy a cheaper one because I didn't want truck payments. So I found last November somebody had a hydro lock on it, and they didn't have the money to fix it. They just were parking it. They said, heck with it. And so I got it super cheap. I towed it to a shop, had an in-frame, had 1.5 million miles on it. We're talking about a T2000 with an ISX in it. And we had it in-framed and the radiator washed out, a whole bunch of stuff done to it. And so it's sitting in the driveway. I could start driving it any time, but now you've got me chicken. So now I'm thinking, do I sell this or try and find something else? Because I've still got this company job, so I don't have to worry about it. There's no payments on it. It's just sitting there. Do I try and sell it? Do I try and run it?
Well,
so I need to hear I need to hear what's my. I'm looking for problems with this truck.
So here's what I would do. Here's the thing. We can't predict which one of these trucks are going to be the problem truck. Now, the case you just heard me talk about is extreme. There's no question. But it's not unusual. I hear lots of those extremes. On average, I have found that after 2004, which that's when emissions really started, I've heard dealers try to claim that your 2007 is a pre-emission truck. That's not true. It has EGR, and that's where the problem started. About 6 out of 10 of them are going to be more of a maintenance problem than I'm willing to deal with. They're going to go through things like turbos, and on the ISX, you got to worry about wiping out a cam. We have some oil pressure issues on the ISX.
The guy that had it before me had put two turbos in it in 5 years. He only had it for 5 years before I got it. He gave me all his maintenance records, and I saw that he put two turbos in it.
Which to me is a lot. I mean, I've owned trucks for, 1.3 million miles, never replaced the turbo. So two is a lot. Not horrible. I've seen some that go through four or five turbos in that time. The ISX is known for turbo issues and cam issues and oil pressure issues, but not all of them. There are people listening to me right now that are probably screaming at their radio saying, you're an idiot, I have an ISX and it runs great. I believe you. Some of them do, and we have no way of predicting which ones will and won't. But here's what I would do. You obviously sound like you're in pretty good financial shape. You were able to buy this truck with cash. You were able to rebuild it with cash. I would take a chance on it. You already own it. If you try to sell it, you're going to lose money on it. You're not going to get what you've got into it. And it might be a good one. If you were asking me, this truck is sitting here, I'm thinking about buying it, it just had an in-frame, I would say run as fast as you can the other way. But you already own it. So let's take a chance. You might have the 4 out of 10, one of those that's going to be just fine. And it's not like the odds of it having some sort of catastrophic failure is pretty slim. If you start running this truck and we can't get any fuel economy out of it, and it starts having issues, you know, the turbo keeps going, or we're always working on the EGR, or then I would say, you know, let's find plan B and get out of this thing and go get a pre-emission truck. But if you start running it and the fuel economy is relatively good and we start making modifications and it gets better and you're not having those problems, then I would say keep it.
Okay, well, I'm scared because I can't sit for weeks without money coming in, so that's my only issue, you know. I mean,
yeah,
I'm not...
Yeah, and like I say, the odds of that are pretty slim. So this isn't an emission truck. It has EGR. Most of my horror stories, I hear more and more horror stories the more complicated these trucks become. So a new ISX probably has two or three times as many sensors on it as yours does. And it's all the complicated electronics and sensors and DPF and SCR. Those are the ones that seem to cause the really horrendous problems, like the one I was talking about. Your truck, you know, the worst problem we usually see with that is it will wipe out cams. And that's not a huge deal. I mean, that's not something that's going to put you out of business. And what I recommend with the ISX is just open up the top end every year and do an overhead on it and inspect the cam.
Okay. Well, I know you probably don't want to comment on this, but I just had it done by a little bitty shop, and he said when he did this that you can correct me, that the ERG was sealed, either closed or opened. I can't remember which one. And he said, leave it, don't pay any attention to it, and you'll get better fuel mileage. But am I going to be in trouble then if, you know, for emissions?
Well, hopefully if somebody tried to fix this, it's closed. We don't want the EGR open. That means we're getting exhaust gas in all the time. We want it closed so we don't get any in, although it's not that simple. People think, well, I'll just, you know, weld this closed, or there's all kinds of ways to fix it, and it may or may not get better fuel economy. The problem is the computer, the ECM, the brains are expecting that to be open, and there's lots of sensors. So if it's running okay, I'd leave it alone. Depending on how they fixed it, I have no idea how. You may or may not have an issue with emissions. I'll say this, though. I don't know. I've heard some rumors here and there, but I don't personally know of a single case where anybody has gotten trouble over, you know, emissions not working right on a truck. I thought I had a couple verified, but I couldn't track them down. So I really just don't see it happening. So I think you're fine. Go out, run this truck. Be smart, track your numbers, and call me once in a while, and we'll talk about it. I think you're going to be fine. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the calls. We're off to Arizona this time. Rusty, welcome to the program. Rusty, are you with me? Maybe. Sounds like somebody might be there. I'll tell you what, Rusty, I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to come back to you in a second. We'll see if we can maybe save that line. Let's go to South Carolina. Bobby, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How are y'all today?
Good. What's on
can
your
you
mind?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I want to make a quick comment about the lady that just called. They're coming to ISX. Pittsburgh Power, awesome place. Great results with the Cummins. Just need to make some good decisions with it. They can retune the ECM and make sure the EGR is done correctly. Of course, I know you know them very well.
Hey, and you're right. I've been beating up on the ISX for a lot of years now because we do see a lot of problems with it, but they have made some really amazing discoveries on how to get that engine to run right. And when it runs right, it really does well.
Yeah, the Cummins, I set out to prove you wrong on a point when I heard you make a comment about the difference between 60 and 70 miles per hour being at least 1 mile per gallon. And the numbers don't lie. I went from 68 to 72 down to 62 and gained 1.4 miles a gallon.
Wow. Profit is just kind of an average. Sometimes it's a little more, sometimes it's a little less.
Yeah, right now, of course, with the profit gauges, I've got your accounting software on the profit gauges. And, of course, where I ran it so long at 5.2 to 5.6 average, now I'm somewhere close to 7. Just doing a few things as I go. I ordered the scan gauge KR, and that's helped a lot. Really changes your driving habits. Like you said yesterday, it's not really an accurate, but maybe an accurate gauge all the time, but it gives you a starting place, you know, reference point.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make a comment, quick comment on the guy that called yesterday on the show, the disgruntled guy with overdimensional. You know, anger doesn't ever solve anything. And, you know, you have to make some informed decisions. And, you know, being an owner-operator is not for everybody.
No.
You know, if you're making the same decisions over and over again, and you're not getting any results, the definition of insanity is the same, doing the same thing expecting a different result.
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand these folks. They want to blame game. They just want somebody to call and fuss at. And you know, this is a great industry that we have, and there's ups and downs in it. And you have to put yourself in a position to go through the lean times as well as the good times, because they're going to come.
Absolutely. Hey, and you made a good point there. Not everybody should be an owner-operator. And then we could go a step further. There are some people that make excellent owner-operators leased to a carrier because they love owning the equipment. They love, you know, some freedom to fix things the way they want to or to own the truck that they want. They like that little bit of freedom. But they don't want to have to worry about the revenue side of things and finding and building relationships with brokers or customers or compliance. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if that's where you want to be, that's where you should be. So then we could go a step further and say some people shouldn't have their own authority. And I think this guy might have been one of them.
So, and, you know, he might be listening today, and, I don't want him to be discouraged because it can work. And maybe, like you said, that going with a broker because there's so much. He's limited himself in specialized. You've got a lot more limited freight in specialized than you do in general commodities. So maybe he needs to consider Landstar or somebody that's in the overdimensional stuff that has a lot more freight, you know, and he can pick better lanes to run it. That's the thing, you know. Of course, there's a 1,000 brokers today that's not going to pay you what you actually need, but, you know, check 1,000 more tomorrow, you know? Just
you
make
know, and,
some
and,
better
and
decisions.
I didn't want to argue with him just to prove him wrong. That's never my point. The reason that I actually love calls like that is it's an opportunity to really bring out a lot of different points and get people to think differently. You know, I can come on and have that conversation by myself for a half hour, But I think it makes a better point when, you know, my whole point was just to try to get him to think differently. His mind is so closed. He's just so convinced that nothing is going to work. And I just think to myself, if I woke up and felt like nothing was going to work, why would you keep doing what you're doing?
Absolutely. You know, and when I said earlier that I said I have to prove you wrong, it wasn't to be argumentative with you. I just thought, I've trucked for 20-something years. He's crazy.
Right.
60, right. 60 and 70, there's no difference. And I did own a Kenworth W900 at one time with a big cat, and there wasn't any difference between 70 and 80 was 1 or 2 tenths, you know. They're just not going to get any fuel mileage, period. Planning a college tuition for my daughter, you know, by just slowing down and listening to you, trying to disprove you, and when the numbers don't lie, you know, I'm going to save $10,000 a year in fuel savings just by slowing down. That's going to go a long way to college tuition.
Absolutely.
You know, just
great stuff.
Just making good decisions. Just wanted to tell you to keep up the good work, man. I know people get disgruntled, and I'm sure you do, and I do as well, but it's a changing industry all the time, and we just have to keep up with the changes. So keep up the good work.
Thank you. Great stuff. Great comments. I know I can get a little argumentative at times, and it's because I'm passionate about what I do. I do a lot of research. I think about this stuff all day long. You know, it's kind of like most drivers are pretty damn good at driving because it's what they do all day long. What I do all day long is I read and I question and I think and I try to prove things or disprove things. So I know I can get a little argumentative, but I have good motivation for why I do it. I want to help people think better and be better. Let's go to Arizona. Rusty, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Kevin. I was questioning whether cab extenders were necessary or dead weight or could even gain fuel economy on a flatbed. I'm currently running 56% empty and 92% under mid-roof height.
The cab extenders are pretty much neutral. They're not really improving anything. They're not hurting anything. I don't think it's enough weight to really worry about taking them off. If anything, I would say throw a set of air tabs on them and leave them where they are.
You wouldn't gain anything by having that rounded back edge of the sleeper?
No.
As opposed to having the square edge on that?
No, because it that little bit of roundness, it's still basically a 90-degree cut. I mean, you get that same vacuum right behind the cab that you're going to get right behind the cab extenders. So they're, like I say, they're just kind of neutral. The one way to cut down on that vacuum that's created right there are the air tabs.
What about a cab tail?
A cab tail?
Yeah, a trailer tail on the back of your cab. Call the cab tail.
Possibly the problem you might run into, and aerodynamics are tricky, really tricky. What seems sometimes simple or obvious really isn't. You know, when I go down and work with Smart Truck, they have some of the best aerodynamic engineers in the business. In fact, probably the best. Guys that came out of Formula One racing, guys that came out of aerospace, where, you know, aerodynamics are absolutely critical. Those are the kind of engineers they've got. And I go down there and talk to them, and they are moving things a half of an inch because that changes the aerodynamics. I mean, we can't just look at something and say, oh, do this and it'll work. It's not even close to that. One of the things you could run into with some sort of a tractor tail with a flatbed is you could be directing the airstream right into your worst spot where the freight is. So
I'm running 56% empty, so that's only 44% of the time.
That's another complication in this. There's no way to know without building it, which isn't easy, you know, fabricating something like that, because there isn't anything on the market. You're going to have to fabricate it yourself. and then you're going to have to test it. And that's the only way we would ever know.
Yeah, I can buy a wreck trailer tail for under $150. So I was just going to hack that up.
Hey, I'd love people that experiment like that. You know, if you have the ability and the time and the desire, that's how we learn. It's the only way we're going to learn. I mean, somebody's just got to do it and see what happens and test it and, you know, verify some numbers. You might be onto something. I've got to get to a break. We'll be right back with more stuff. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. I'm going to head off to Indiana this time. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
What can I help you with?
I'm getting ready to lease on a Landstar, and I've been going through your stop holding the steering wheel program again. And this
Good.
Morning, I got my my EIN with a DVA. And you see, it's F that it says to get a business checking and a savings account. Now, I currently have my personal account through a credit union. I've got a checking account through a national bank that I've been using to save the money for the truck. I was wondering, is there any real advantage of getting a business checking versus a personal checking? Because the business checking has got more fees involved and all that, and I don't see a point of distinguishing it as that kind of account.
Yeah, you make a good point. I use business, and I should probably explain it a little better. Maybe I should just say a separate account. It doesn't have to be a business account. Yeah, if you can get away with a personal account and they'll let you do direct deposit, you know, of a settlement check into it, then knock yourself out. Do the personal account. All I really want is that it be separate from your personal checking accounts so that it's just much easier to do accounting that way.
Okay. Yeah, because I look online and some of the only thing I see negative is some places say that if you have a personal account, you can't deposit a check that's written to your business, but as
as somebody that was kind of what I was getting to.
A company, there's no point, right?
Right. So that was my only point.
Okay.
As long as you're clear with your institution, whether it's a bank or a credit union, you go in and say, "Look, you know, here's where my money comes from. Can I do a direct deposit into this kind of account? And if you can, then yeah, go with the cheaper option."
I'm gone. I'm losing you.
All right. Well, I think we got that one taken care of, so we will move on. We're going to head off to Kentucky. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Got a question about Jake brakes on a C10, a Caterpillar 10 motor.
Okay.
Okay, what happens is the truck recently had an in-frame, and when you turn the engine brake on, the check engine light comes on, and I don't notice any other thing other than the check engine light come on. No, it doesn't affect the performance or anything, but it's kind of strange, and I'm worried I'm going to make something worse by running it. And the only other thing I've noticed is the engine smokes slightly when you first start it. Do you have any idea where I might start looking? Because I don't understand if it's electrical, mechanical, or both.
Okay, so let's do the engine brake first. I know next to nothing about the C10. Is that a true Jake brake or some other form of engine brake?
Well, I wish I could answer that. I know it's a true engine brake. That's all I know.
Is it an engine brake or an exhaust brake?
Yeah, see, I just don't know enough about them.
Yeah, see, I don't know the C10 well enough to know. Sometimes the smaller engines tend to use exhaust brakes. Even the Mercedes,
okay.
12-liter was an exhaust brake, not an engine brake. So,
okay.
When we use the term Jake brake, we use it kind of generically, but it's very specific. It's a Jacobs engine brake, which is a very specific design.
Right.
And like I say, I just don't know enough about the C10 to know what you've got on there.
Right.
The only thing you can really do with this is get somebody. You're not going to hurt anything. The odds that anything is really wrong with it is pretty slim. I do know that it could be a wiring harness issue. We do see,
okay.
If it's a Jake brake, we do see a wiring harness issues on that old throw an engine light. If the engine brake is functioning properly, then there's probably nothing wrong. Kind of annoying, and if the light comes on, you're always wondering. You just have to find somebody who can troubleshoot this and figure out why the light's coming on. But I wouldn't worry about using it. As far as the smoke, what color is the smoke?
It's like a grayish color.
Are you doing oil samples?
Yes, I am, and I'm glad you asked. The engine's only got about 7,300 miles on it since this end frame. I'm the guy that runs the straight box, the handful of straight box trucks. They all have the C10 auto shifts. One's a manual, but, yeah, I do have the OPS on board, and I was going to ask, should I go on and do an oil sample or wait a little longer? But like I said, everything seems to be working fine.
White or gray smoke is a little tough. It could be a little excess fuel. It could be some condensation, coolant. That's why the oil sample is our in the beginning. Let's see
right.
if we're getting fuel dilution or coolant. Rather than just go in and start poking around and looking for something, let's see if the oil sample will tell us. So, yeah, I would be, if you've got 7,300 miles on an in-frame, I'd be doing an oil change and take the sample
okay.
right before you change it.
Okay, yeah, it's just really strange because, like I said, if you let the engine, you turn the engine off at all, let it sit for any time at all, and then you go to start it, it smokes briefly just right upon you starting it, and then it goes away.
It like I say, it could just be an injector that's dripping a little bit when it sits. So you get a buildup
okay.
of too much fuel in there. Then when you start it, that's where that smoke's coming from. It could be a little coolant coming from somewhere. But this is
okay.
a perfect time to just go ahead and take the sample and then change that initial oil.
All right, sir. Thanks as always.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about the C10 specifically. Let's go to Kansas. Calvin, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Kevin?
Good. What can I help you with today?
All right. So I ordered your kit, part one, part two, and thanks to you guys over there having the GoFundMe thing set up, I'm able to go to the CMC this year. And,
oh, congratulations.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate that. My fiance, she did the nominating and everything for me, and you guys gave me a call, surprised me, and I'll see you guys in a little while. But
awesome.
My thing is, I'm finishing up my year with the company. It's my first, year driving, and I'm really, really leaning towards the owner-operator thing and learning about the pre-emissions. And I found the glider trucks at Snyder selling the pre-owned gliders. Snyder is selling, average about 50,000. I'm thinking about either doing that and heading over to Landstar with that, or I have some buddies that, you know, live in my hometown, and those guys are like doing the dualies, hauling the cars, and with that, I see them, you know, they seem to be home more often, and I'm always traveling no more than about, I say, 300-400 miles away from home, and seem to be doing pretty well financially, so kind of tossed between the two, you know, like home time and pay, and just want to know what was your thoughts on that?
You know, I love questions like this because there isn't a wrong answer. Both of these answers could be right. I mean, you know, one of the things with Landstar, because you kind of get to pick and choose your own freight, it's not that difficult to be home a lot more often. You know, I've looked. I could go to Landstar's board, and depending on where I wanted to live in the country, home a couple times a week. Wouldn't be hard at all.
Right.
You just start working on, you know, some agents and some relationships that, you know, freight that comes through your house, around the house, that can be done. Autos, it's easier to stay local pulling cars. Here's the thing that I would check with. Depending on where you are, if these guys are pulling cars with dualies, they're probably only doing 3 and 4 cars on a trailer, right?
Exactly, yep.
The question would be, I wouldn't want to go compete in that arena. The whole thing is, even if I don't have a full-blown car hauler, I don't have to have the tractor all decked out, I can get twice as many cars on if I do a tractor and a car hauler trailer. The question is there enough work? Could I keep enough cars on that trailer to make it worth it? If so, that's what I'd be interested in. I wouldn't want to go pull 3 cars at a time with a dually. I'd want to go pull 6 or 7 because you're going to double the amount of revenue and your expenses aren't going to go up that much at all. So that's let me get to a break and I'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment already. I'm going to get right back to the phone calls. I was talking with Calvin in Kansas. So, Calvin, I would take some time, talk to your friends, find out where they're getting their cars from, go talk to that source, say, you know, I'm interested in this, but I would want to do it with a, you know, a car hauling trailer where I could pull more cars. Is there enough work? So I would keep looking at that. And see what the possibilities are there.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Yeah, don't be afraid to go down. You know, a lot of people say, well, I don't want to go talk to them. I don't even own a truck. Yeah, that's the point. We want to do the homework ahead of time. Most people that have freight to move, whether it's cars or whatever it is, they're looking for good owner-operators. Go talk to them. Say, this is my plan, but I want to do it right. Let's talk about, you know, how many cars are available, what the rates are. Let's crunch some numbers. If you can get that information before you come to the CMC, then you and I will have some time to go over it in person, and I'd be glad to help you out with that. Let's go to Minnesota. Wally, welcome to the program.
Hey, hello. I got a couple questions. One's going to be on health. Second's going to be on truck. And I wanted to comment with a fellow you just got done with right before me there.
Sure.
So here's the numbers that I got for my health-wise. I'm 5'10", 320 pounds. I lost 10 pounds a month ago. And what woke me up from that is the fact that a coworker of mine, when I used to work for another company, he got a stroke. He was 55 years old and got him some stroke. And I thought, well, how the hell did you do that? And he says, well, it's the food you're eating. And what folks didn't, what I didn't realize is when you read on nutrition stuff there is when you read that nutrition value and it says per serving, you take that per serving. And if you're eating, like I was eating these yakisoba meals, if you guys ever gone out to the Walmart to pick those things up, you put water in them, put them in a microwave, you heat them up for a minute, you got yourself a so-called meal. And I was reading the nutrition value on them. It's two servings, and the things I was told to look out for was carbs, sodium, and sugar. And when I read the serving on that, it was like 1,300 milligrams of sodium and times that by two. I was like, holy crap, that's what I'm eating? This is why I can get a heart attack? And anyway, my curiosity to you is about the ketogenic. Does – if I had to starve myself for one day, does that help burn that fat off, or what is going on in that process doing that ketogenic dieting?
Got it. So let's talk a little bit about sodium real quick, because looking for carbs and sugar, absolutely, they're the same. And that's what we want to avoid. That's what's causing more health problems than anything right now. Second list of offenders are industrial, heavily processed seed and vegetable oils. Cottonseed oil, soybean oil, corn oil, corn syrup, all that. The thing is, our bodies were never designed to eat that stuff. It's not food. You know, if there's an ingredient list, there's a good chance it's not real food. So we want to eat as close to real food as we possibly can. The thing about salt, most of what we've known is not true. Salt itself does not cause high blood pressure. It's the quality of the salt we use, and it's the balance between salt, magnesium, and potassium in our diet. So what we tend to do is we tend to eat really bad salt, that iodized table salt, and that's what's in all processed food. But if we're eating real sea salt, unprocessed, pink Himalayan salt, that stuff's got minerals in it. It's good for us. Our body needs salt. We also, though, have to make sure that we're balancing it with the right amount of magnesium and potassium. And that comes from whole, real foods like, you know, avocados and raw chocolate and things like that. So salt isn't necessarily the enemy. It's just in processed food, we're getting way too much junk salt, and we're not getting the magnesium and the potassium to balance it. That makes sense?
Okay. So
now, on the ketogenic, let's get to that.
Okay.
So here's the easiest way I can explain this. Your body can create energy out of a couple things. It can create energy out of carbohydrates. It can create energy out of protein. It's not very efficient at that. And it can create energy out of fat. And fat is our most efficient form of energy. Fat also doesn't cause blood sugar spikes. So we would prefer to have our bodies run on fat. Problem is, our body will burn whatever fuel is available in the order of what's easiest to burn. And carbohydrates are very easy for our body to burn for energy. And as long as we keep feeding our body carbohydrates, which is sugar, starch, grains, bread, pastas, rice, potatoes, all that stuff, as long as that's present in our diet, then the body will just keep looking at the fat and saying, we don't need that. We have carbohydrates for energy, and it just keeps storing the fat. That's why we keep getting fatter and fatter. If we get rid of the carbohydrates, and on a ketogenic diet, you get rid of almost all of them, when you do that, your body all of a sudden says, hey, wait a minute, we need energy, and we don't see any carbohydrates around. So we're going to start burning fat for energy instead. So it will burn the fat you eat in your diet, but it will also burn the fat that you've been storing. that's how we lose weight. That's why we lose so much weight on a ketogenic diet. Your body also won't need to store as much water as it used to, because processing carbohydrates requires a lot of water in your body to do it. So in the beginning, you tend to lose a lot of water weight. That will slow down after a week or two, and then you'll really start burning the fat. But you've got to make sure you don't give your body the carbohydrate. You give it good fats, a little bit of protein, and very, very little carbohydrates, especially in the beginning.
So here's a dumb question then. Why is it so you go out to like GNC and they always have these protein shakes. They're selling protein as a big deal. What is going on with that there? I mean, it kind of seems outrageous if you only need minimum protein, and these guys are saying, oh, load up on protein, get protein shakes.
You said the key word. They're selling. There's money to be made.
Okay.
Lots of money to be made. But the scientific evidence says we don't need nearly what the amount of protein most people are eating. Most of our food has a lot of protein in it. The biggest problem I find on a ketogenic diet is getting enough food that's high in fat and not so high in protein. The last thing I want to do is add more protein to my diet with an expensive supplement.
Yeah. All right. My next question is on thinking about purchasing a truck, and it's from the company I'm working with, and I just neglected it after I realized I got off the phone with a gal to schedule me here. I had a motorized schedule calculator on how they wanted to do it, and it was they're selling their trucks for $17,000, $3,500 down at 8% for 24 months, and their total deductions are $298. That includes the base plate, insurance, bobtail, base plate, trip packs, $2,290, but only through July.
Let's not get too deep into the weeds on the little details that aren't going to matter much. Let me talk about two big things that matter for me. What year are the trucks?
07 International Eagle 9400i.
Yeah. I don't want them for a lot of reasons. The biggest one being they're 07. They're emission trucks. I just don't want to own one of these. They're too much risk. The second question would be, when on the day that you signed this deal, does your name get put on the title as the legal owner of the vehicle and they hold a lien on the title, or is their name going to remain on the title until you pay it off?
My name's on the title. They put a lien on it.
That part I like. That is more like traditional financing. So that's good. Most leases aren't that way. So they're really selling it to you and financing it for you. I like that. I just don't want to own an 07.
Even though it's just EGR?
Just EGR. That's what started all of our problems.
So, okay, because, yeah, this one was produced in September of 06, so it doesn't have that DPF filter on it.
No, I get it, and they'll try to convince you that means it's pre-emission. It's not. It's not pre-emission at all. EGR was the first real problem. I mean, that's when all of our problems started. Those are the engines that have turbo issues, V-pod issues, EGR valve issues, EGR cooler issues. So, you know, clearly your choice, and I like the rest of the stuff. I am just dead set against owning one of these trucks. It's just not worth the risk for me. There's the music. They're chasing me out of here, so I'll see you back here next time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Looks like we'll see you tomorrow for an hour of Pittsburgh Power and an hour of general questions. Thanks.